Breadbox Media Programming is brought to you by...
Finding someone on an online Catholic dating site shouldn't be like shopping for a blender. So why do most dating sites leave you feeling like you're shopping for a spouse? At Catholic Singles, we connect members through our unique user polls and activities, which help you discover other members and their personalities and interests. Because you're a person, not a profile picture. So stop shopping and start discerning. Trust your love story to the original Catholic dating site and use the promo code BREADBOX at checkout for 20% off at catholicsingles.com.
Here we are. A good evening, my fellow truth seekers. Glad you could join us tonight on Beneath the Surface here at WCAP Radio on your dial, 980 AM. Welcome back to another edition of Beneath the Surface, where faith and reason meets every Monday evening between 10 and 11 p.m. As usual, bringing a little sanity into our age of insanity, a little life into our culture of death. Well, tonight, ladies and gentle things, our topic of the evening is physician-assisted suicide and euthanasia. And to join me in that conversation to delve beneath the surface with your questions is Mr. John Tudorus. John, welcome to Beneath the Surface.
Hey, Paul.
Now, that's not your real voice.
No.
I know your real voice.
It's only funnier when Bob is here because that's an impression of Bob, and then Bob then impersonates someone impersonating him, which I think is really great.
Okay, just to remind the folks at home that you are an amateur impersonator.
Yes, in fact, sometimes it's very bad, so that I actually have to give people money for my performance.
Yes, that's how amateur it is.
Yes.
And why don't you give us at least a president or two?
That's right.
Okay, I know who that is. Do you have the latest one?
Oh, tremendous, huge, China.
No, it's too bad that they couldn't see your hands on that whole thing, because that really did it. 978-454-4980 is not your phone number. Actually, I don't know what your phone number is, but that's our phone number. So if you want to give us a call and talk about perhaps your experience or any two cents that you might have on this issue of physician-assisted suicide or euthanasia, we'd love to hear from you because, you know, we're not experts. We just are a couple of... philosophers yakking about. So give us a call again, 978-454-4980 here at WCAP. All right. So, Mr. John, got a serious topic here tonight, do we not?
Yes, it is. I was thinking of a play on words.
Yes.
That we would be doing a show about youths in Asia.
Youths, yeah.
Yeah, youths in Asia. But anyway.
Yeah. Yes. This is not a show about young people in the continent of Asia.
No, not at all.
It's a show about euthanasia, though.
Yes, which is actually, you're right, it's not a, when you really think about it, not a pleasant topic, because at its core there's some...
Well, the interesting part about this topic is, and I have noticed this for the past few years, that virtually all of my students, and I teach at a couple of colleges, almost all of them, see no reason whatsoever to oppose euthanasia or physician-assisted suicide. Now, I want to get to that and why and talk about all of that, but I think we first need to define and talk about the what regarding this topic. So first, let's distinguish between physician-assisted suicide and euthanasia. What is the difference?
Well, I mean, physician-assisted suicide would be part of euthanasia, which is more of a broader term.
So physician-assisted suicide literally is when the physicians or the doctors give the patients what they need to commit suicide.
Yes, yes. And there's, for the most part, it's assumed that it's a voluntary consent.
Right.
To that.
Right. So then it's not the doctor doing it, it's the patient doing it, but the patient asks for the means to do it.
Yes.
So the doctor gives them that overdose or whatever it is, so the patient does it themselves.
Yes.
Okay. So euthanasia is more directly involved with the physician. And we'll get into the difference between active and passive, but first, tell me the difference between voluntary and involuntary euthanasia.
Well, voluntary, so in the example you give there, the person who is requesting to die is voluntarily saying, yes, I want to die. Now, in some cases, for example, I think it was Denmark,
yeah,
where they actually can do so with children, right? Where they can just pull the plug in certain circumstances. And that, of course, would be involuntary. I mean, if the child, for example, hasn't reached the age of reason, maybe they're in tough shape medically, and they say, well, it's just better to pull the plug. So the...
But wouldn't they say that the parent speaks for the child in that situation?
They, yes, at least legally so.
Right, right. But you're saying that wouldn't be ethical because that it's the child's life and the parent shouldn't just say, you know, a thumbs up or a thumbs down to their child's life.
Well, it's also at its core unethical because it's, right. I don't think we're the arbiters of our own
life. We'll get to that in a little while. I just want to get through the definitions here.
Sure.
All right, so then... There is voluntary euthanasia, which is what, when people say they're for euthanasia, that's what they mean, because it's the patient voluntarily asking for it, whereas involuntary euthanasia is euthanasia, a patient being euthanized without their consent, or independent,
yes,
of their consent. And rumor has it that this kind of euthanasia does occur once in a while in these other countries of which euthanasia is legalized.
Or even unofficially here in the United States. Every once in a while you talk to people in the healthcare industry and you might hear of someone maybe in hospice who is a little too eager to pull the plug on someone. So, and that's a very unfortunate thing, but it's when you have enough of the mentality going around where people think that it's okay even if it's officially not legal, you might actually get some people who are in position with that willingness to actually pull the plug.
One reason that some people are against euthanasia, at least for now, is because they fear of the slippery slope argument that once it becomes legal, then it'll sort of slowly evolve from always voluntary to sometimes involuntary.
Yes. I had actually heard of stories of that in Denmark,
yes,
the Netherlands, which would be considered one of the trailblazers, if you will, in the euthanasia movement.
Now, if you think the more and more the government gets involved in healthcare, the more decision-making they will take upon themselves. And especially when it comes to the elderly or those that don't have a good diagnosis, you know, it might be the government that makes those kinds of decisions as to whether or not to keep a person alive rather than the person themselves or their families.
Well, it's really a shame, too, that it would come to that because it really ignores the principle of subsidiarity. It takes away decision-making, which is really ideally best made on the local level, and then subsumes it to a higher level.
I think if the government takes over the healthcare system, they will be the ones with the funds, so they have to make the decisions.
Yes,
you know what I mean?
Which is a real shame. It's really not in the best interest of a society or even in the government for a healthy operation, a healthy government as far as doing what a government is supposed to do, to get involved with things that are really out of their purview.
Okay. So that's the difference between voluntary and involuntary euthanasia. Tell me the difference between active and passive euthanasia.
Well, so the active, of course, is you know, again, that example of someone saying, Maybe they got cancer, and maybe I'm in the state of Washington or Oregon. And I say, I just got diagnosed with cancer. They give me 6 months to live. I say, you know what? I want to go out on my terms, doc. Can you pull the plug? Sure, fill the papers, sign it, dot the line here. I'm in my bed. I got my family around. Boop. They just put it in the bloodstream. It goes in. I'm done.
Well, let me question you on that, because the states that you mentioned, I think only physician-assisted suicide is legal in those states. I don't think euthanasia itself is.
Well, physician-assisted suicide would be considered part of euthanasia, would it not?
Well, strictly speaking, it would simply be the doctor giving them the means so that they would do it themselves. It's not the doctor doing anything else.
So you're saying the person on their in the bed has to go in and actually inject themselves with?
Well, probably take an overdose of something.
Hmm. Interesting. I haven't gotten too much into the legalities of that.
Okay. But anyway, the difference between active and passive, you would say, is that active is when the physician themselves actively gives the patient an overdose.
Oh, sure.
At the patient's request, so that they would, with the intention of causing their death.
Yes.
So passive is what you had mentioned a little earlier, right? That it's not giving the patient something intending them to die. It's not giving the patient something with the intention of their death.
A good public example of that would be the Terry Schiavo case from a few years back, where purposefully the means of sustenance of her life were actually withheld. Mm. And it took a good couple weeks before she actually died, which is an indication that she was not in a vegetative state, because someone who is basically starved without food and water for 2 weeks and last that long, it clearly wants to live.
Maybe not consciously or will. Maybe not consciously, but certainly there's something within her that certainly wanted to live.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. I mean, her cerebrum was like, what do you call it? Liquid, almost liquid. Her entire cerebrum. So there was no higher brain thinking in Terry Schiavo, if I'm not mistaken. I'm trying to remember the case, but she was alive. Her vital organs remained alive. Her heart beat. She sweat like everybody else. She went to the bathroom. All of those things, but she was in what they call the persistent vegetative state. In as much as her eyes were open, but she couldn't really respond to things. But her mother thought that her eyes moved one way or another to follow things. So it was a little disputed as to if there was any conscious awareness in Terry or not. But the fact is that her body, herself, was alive.
Yes, very much so.
And she was severely brain damaged.
Yes, and one may argue that the withholding of sustenance may have actually exacerbated that, if you will.
So then we need to make a distinction here between passive euthanasia, which is not giving the patient ordinary medications or means in order to keep them alive, you know, purposely or intentionally withdrawing that so that the patient would die, versus simply letting nature take its course and allowing a patient to die. Now, ethicists have made a distinction here between ordinary and extraordinary means of keeping a patient alive, and some call it proportionate versus disproportionate means. So passive euthanasia basically is intentionally withdrawing ordinary means of care that would keep this person alive. And you would say that food and water, like in the Terry Schiavo case, would be ordinary means of care. Yes?
Yes, very much ordinary.
Yeah, because if you take away food and water from you or I, we die too. So
yes,
it's very ordinary.
Yes, and that's, of course, assuming that the person is well enough to receive it. There are cases where actually giving someone food and water, the body rejects it and actually becomes an added suffering.
Hmm.
And usually at that point, it's an indication that the natural course of life is running its course.
Yes, yes, yes. Yeah, I mean, if the body doesn't absorb anything and the person is shutting down, then that's a good indication. But this is something else. This wasn't that. So there's definitely a difference between passive euthanasia and allowing nature to take its course and somebody to peacefully die. Now, you don't have to give people extraordinary means of care. It's morally optional. Whereas ordinary means of care is morally obligatory, like food and water, a comfortable bed, simple medications or simple surgeries for healthy people who can take it.
Yes.
All of those things are ordinary care that if a person says, no, I don't want those, then they're asking basically for passive euthanasia if they're in a good, healthy state. Now, if somebody is around 90 years old and they need a heart operation, for example, there's little chance that he may not survive the heart operation because they have so many other things wrong with him. This may be considered extraordinary care and morally optional.
Actually, even more than that, I know we got a commercial break coming up, but I think this is worth talking about a little bit more when we get back from the break.
Okay. Want to give us a tease?
Yes, there's more to it than that.
All right. There you go. Looking forward to it after the break. 978-454-4980 is our phone number. You're listening to Beneath the Surface. Our topic tonight, physician-assisted suicide and euthanasia. Will it be legal someday? We'll talk about all that and more right after this. Welcome back. We are back here on Beneath the Surface. Tonight, we delve beneath the surface on the topic of physician-assisted suicide and euthanasia. It is legal in a handful of states and in a few countries. Will it become legal in yours? My guest tonight is Mr. John Tudorus, and as usual, behind the glass is my producer, Cindy, and I am me. So let's get to it, Mr. John. Before the break, you wanted to make a distinction between extraordinary means of keeping somebody alive and versus means that would probably be unethical to even attempt?
Oh, yes. And in fact, what came to mind was, and I won't mention any specific names, but a friend of mine was a nurse, and I remember her giving an example of this doctor who presented to this elderly couple. So a wife was pretty much on death's door. Her time was coming, and the husband, and again, they're both very elderly, and he's very distraught, his wife of, you know, 50 plus years or what have you, and the doctor basically sells him on this surgery that just may have some way of extending her life, even if it just for an extra week or what have you, but really, all it ended up doing is just burdening this man with a debt of tens of thousands of extra dollars for this surgery that really had little to no hope of doing anything at all meaningful for this woman, and only actually adding to her suffering because of the time it takes to recover from such surgeries.
If she did recover. Now, were both parties, the husband and the wife, on board with this?
Apparently, it was him making the decision.
Okay, for her. Yeah.
Exactly. And, of course, he was so emotionally distraught. And, obviously, I'm getting this from a... You know,
but this would be your example of what would certainly be disproportionate means.
Exactly. Very disproportionate. At this point, the best decision most likely would have been just, you know, her time is coming.
Yeah.
These means here, you know, the best thing to do if it came up in conversation to say, look, most likely it's not going to have any benefit other than, and the only thing it would really do is put you, you know, tens of thousands of dollars in debt for something, and I really don't want to do that for you.
Mm.
So, get a priest, whatever it is you need in order to prepare for the next stage.
Yeah, it's like the difference between prolonging life versus prolonging death, or prolonging living versus prolonging dying.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So then, we have so far made distinctions between voluntary and involuntary euthanasia, between active and passive euthanasia, between passive euthanasia and allowing somebody to die naturally, and between euthanasia itself and physician-assisted suicide. So all of those definitions are now in place. If you missed us at the beginning, you missed some of those, but you probably know what they are anyway. Before we get into whether you think that euthanasia and physician-assisted suicide should be legal, are there any precedents in history that euthanasia and physician-assisted suicide have been legal, other than the handful of countries and states in the United States?
Oh, sure. Well, actually, one that comes to mind is ancient Rome, with the common practice of leaving undesirable babies and children out in the wild, with the idea that they wouldn't be able to care for themselves and would most likely die.
So that would be simply a... I guess an example of passive euthanasia.
Yes.
You don't give what the child needs in order to survive with the intention that they die.
Exactly.
So that was a common practice in ancient Rome?
It was. And actually, the funny thing is, I remember some of the early ancient Christians, one of the practices that they would do in ancient Rome is that they would actively look for these children and actually give them a second chance at life.
Yeah.
And they would raise them almost like an orphanage, if you will. I don't know what they had back 2,000 years ago, but they would essentially go on these little rescue missions and actively look for these children sometimes in order to give them, you know, that chance that they otherwise would not have had.
Interesting. So it was just part of the culture at the time.
Yeah.
Now, you mentioned Nazi Germany. Tell me about your thoughts there.
Yeah, there was a lot of bad stuff that happened in Nazi Germany, but one of the things that they looked to do was actually remove undesirables, people who were sick, not even just ethnic cleansing, which a lot of people, of course, heard about, which happened in a lot of the concentration camps. But in prepping for the show, one really extreme example came up. And it was, what was that name of that place? That was the Harthium Euthanasia Center. So it was actually a castle, and of course, in Austria. And, of course, like a lot of things around Nazi Germany, they just basically acquisitioned it for themselves, for their own purposes. They actually built in gas chambers in there. And within the span of less than a year and a half, they had gassed and killed over 18,000 people. And of course, once the whole death machine started going, it wasn't just the sick that they were killing off. It was, you know, they were getting spillover from concentration camps. They were bringing them over there to get gas, too. So it was a pretty awful thing that was going on there. But just this idea that the sick use up resources, it's just easier to just gas them and kill them.
It's pretty amazing, isn't it?
Amazing in a very bad way.
Yeah. So euthanasia. I mean, the people of Germany were a free people until, of course, the Nazis took over, and then all hell broke loose. It could happen here.
Oh, it can. I mean, obviously, the dynamics of the United States is a much larger country.
Right.
But some of the recipe, if you will, for takeover. Some of those elements can be seen, even in a country as large as this.
Okay, so with Nazi Germany and other countries, basically we had involuntary euthanasia going on.
Yes.
Now, what is becoming more and more popular today, and I know this from experience, is voluntary euthanasia. If there was a vote, I think almost every state in the nation would probably vote yes for voluntary euthanasia. And I think this is because we are more and more seeing ourselves as autonomous, I'd say radically individual. And we want to be the arbiters of life and death, not only at the beginning of life, and that's, of course, the abortion issue, but also at the end of life. We want to be in control of ourselves and our life. We want to be the arbiter of that decision as to when we die, especially if there's suffering involved. This is the mentality that we have today, and I know, like I said before, I know it because I teach these issues, and virtually all the students are leaning towards saying, yes, that should be, that is my purview, that is my right.
Sadly, I would agree with you in that observation.
And now, you say sadly, why?
Because it's a disconnect from reality. I mean, we really think about it, did we do anything at all to deserve our existence? None. We didn't.
No.
We're a product of our parents, and they themselves are a product of their parents, and so on and so on and so on. None of us actually willed ourselves into existence or the creators of ourselves. So even though we have free will, we have these powers of intellect and will, that doesn't mean that we can extend beyond who we are.
All right, so we have free will, we have intellect and will, as you say. These are powers we use all the time to determine our lives and determine our destinies.
And to make right judgments.
So here's my question. Where is the line to which we cannot go over in making a decision?
Well, look at our life, right? So if we are not the creators of our own life, does that mean that we have the power to, or rather the authority?
The authority.
The authority to take our own life if we want to. And the answer is no. It wasn't there in the beginning. Why should it be there at the end?
So, in other words, we didn't have the authority to create ourselves.
Correct.
And hence, we do not have the authority to destroy ourselves.
Correct.
It's interesting you mention this because in my classes, I tell the students there's one question that, depending on how somebody answers this question, would point directly to where they stand on the question of euthanasia. And that is, ultimately, whose am I?
Well, ultimately, I would say God.
Well, you would say God's, but there are three general ways that one could answer that question, possibly. One, of course, is I am my own. And if you answer that question that way, you know, whose am I? Ultimately, I am my own. Then, of course, you're going to be for the legalization of euthanasia. That makes sense, doesn't it?
I would say it does, unless I'm so selfish that I want to live instead.
Right, but. Right. And then the second way is, which you just mentioned, somebody could answer it, I am God's. Ultimately, I am God's, even though I have free will. Like you said, I didn't create myself, therefore I don't have a right to destroy myself, and therefore only God has the authority to take innocent human life. And that would be the other end. But then there's a middle ground in this, a third kind of answer, and that is, I am others, or loved ones, to be more specific, or societies, to be a little more general. And this takes in a lot of considerations about responsibilities, for example, and, you know, if you're parents, you know, children, and et cetera, et cetera. But it seems like once those things are put in place, somebody who takes that middle ground is ultimately, philosophically, agrees with those who say, I am my own. And these are really the two ways, I think, that to look at life, to look at existence, and it's the undergirding of our culture war today. Those who believe ultimately they are their own versus those who believe ultimately they belong to God.
Yeah, although I would say that the other category, to a certain degree, does fall under the God one, in so much as that God is seen as other.
You mean the middle category?
Yeah, the middle category actually seems more compatible with the God category than with the self category.
I'm not sure, because once things are settled, for example, if you think I belong to my loved ones in as much as they need me, but once you settle a situation to which they no longer need you, then you feel free to, you know, make your own decision about life and death. No?
I mean, if someone's looking at it purely from my immediate relationships.
Yes.
Although I don't know if people always think that way. I think others still in that category of God, even more so. Now, that's not, of course, there's varying opinions in there, and you'll ultimately find people hitting on both those spectrums, but
yeah, it seems like when I say that, when I talk about that question, which is whose am I, my classes either go one way or the other. They go my own or God's. Very, very little go in the middle, in terms of their own opinions or what they how they look at things. And in the People's Republic of Massachusetts, where I teach, basically the, you know, I don't know, maybe 80-90% of the students say they are their own, therefore euthanasia should be legal. That's the prevailing mentality, at least of young adults in our society today, and at least up here in the Northeast.
I think you have a certain advantage in that you ask these questions often of your classes, which I don't have that immediate advantage. I suppose part of the optimistic part of me wants to see that people would want to choose other. Sadly, though, I think the evidence is pointing more towards what you're experiencing when you're given these surveys. No.
What's interesting about it is that most or many of those who choose I am my own consider themselves religious, and I'll put quotation marks around that.
Do you mean religious or spiritual but not religious?
It's one of those sort of religious-ish. They usually say they believe in God, and they kind of have their own vague way of understanding what that means, and very often it means being able to choose whatever you want to do in life because God gives you free will and he's forgiving and all of that, all of those errors that are misunderstandings, that is.
So you'd say like a modernist version of a deist?
Well, yeah, I would say so, yeah. Yeah, okay. Pretty much. So it seems like if these polls are any indication, society not only is going to continue to legalize prenatal homicide, but it will legalize homicide at the end of one's life for various reasons, like for the reason of suffering. And it's interesting how both of these things fly in the face of the traditional bedrock foundational principle, moral principle, that has always defined murder, and that is one can never intentionally kill an innocent human being. And with euthanasia, of course, with abortion that's the case, but with euthanasia that's still the case. Now somebody might say, well, that human being is me, and I have the right to do what I want with myself. And my question is, who says you have a right to do with yourself what you want with yourself?
It's a very legitimate question.
Yeah, where did you get this right? Where does it come from?
And if I was that youth, I would probably be very shocked that you would even say something like that, because why would someone question that? But I think if you're right, if someone actually thinks about it, you know, for example, we mentioned earlier, we do not generate our own life. We are not. Who says that even though we have this intellect and will, that we are to use these powers to end our life, which was really a gift that we never earned?
That's right. So an atheist might say, okay, I didn't create myself, but my parents did. So if they say it's okay, then it's okay. Yes?
No. Who created your parents?
Exactly. Parents are only instrumental means to the end of your existence.
Exactly. Right. If you trace all these various causes of people through time, ultimately you come to that uncaused cause. That the only necessary being, every other being is all contingent upon that one being. And that's a philosophical argument. But a good one, I think. I think it's a good one.
But if you live in an era that doesn't think, that doesn't reason things out, and most people would simply say that I am my own autonomous, my own God, basically. I am my own God. How in the world do you expect to have a society that is not a culture of death?
Well, you can't. You can't. It's an inevitable conclusion.
Okay.
It is. Our thoughts have consequences. Our actions have consequences. If people think that in a very libertarian type of way that you know, I can do whatever I want so long as it doesn't harm other people. What they often don't realize is that the things that we do, even if it's not something that's going to cause, let's say, an effect in society that that's outwardly very bad. For example, a drunk driver goes off, swerves, and creates an accident, possibly kills someone. Obviously, we'd say, okay, well, that's not good. You shouldn't do that. But even the things that we do in private have an effect with how we interact with others. Everything has consequences.
It seems like that is such a difficult, if not impossible, thing for people today to understand. Because people have been so formed in this false understanding of liberty that as long as you do, as long as there's adult consent and you do it in private and you're not immediately harming somebody that you can see, then it's okay. In fact, it's not even a moral judgment because I've already consented to it and it's me.
Very selfish indeed.
You call that selfish?
Very much so.
I'll ask you why after the break. You're listening to Beneath the Surface. Our topic tonight is euthanasia and physician-assisted suicide. Paul Morano here with my guest, John Tudoris. Cindy's behind the glass, just waiting for my show to end so that Cindy's Vinyl Vaults can come your way at 11 o'clock. But we've got about 15 minutes left, so don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. Here it comes. All right, there it is, 978-454-4980. You're listening to Beneath the Surface here at WCAP Radio, 980 on your dial. Paul Morano here with my guest, Mr. John Tudoris, talking about the topic, going beneath the surface on the topic of physician-assisted suicide and euthanasia. All right, so John, before break, we had talked about the notion of so many people have adopted this modern understanding of liberty that has somebody as their own god, their own ultimate authority, a total autonomous being that has a right over life, and death decisions, and can take life, particularly one's own, at one's own will, especially if there are mitigating circumstances. Now, you call this selfishness.
Yes.
Somebody would say this is just me exercising my freedom. Tell me the difference.
Well, I mean, selfishness is, I mean, I suppose if we were to use a loose definition, we would say it's to prize our own wants and desires over what is right and true.
Okay. So what is right and true here?
Well, what is right and true is that we are not the arbiters of our own life, and we don't actually have that legitimate authority to take our own life at our own discretion.
To me and you, there is nothing more obvious than that statement. It's like saying, you know, what color is that door? It's green. That's how obvious that is to me and you, that we don't have the authority to take our own lives. Why is this so missing from so many people today?
I think it's because people are generally conditioned to be selfish. I mean, little children, for example.
To be selfish, yes, but perhaps. But to know the difference, like I can know what is true and still be selfish. You know what I mean? These people don't even know that there's no awareness. It seems that we have no authority whatsoever to take our own life in any situation.
Using a broad brushstroke, I would also say that our reason is very malformed. Just the things that should be so obvious are.
Well, what's obvious to them is I am mine, I am an autonomous being, and I get to decide ultimately what happens to me. So, I mean, how this is so false, it is so demonic, it's such an evil attitude to have, and yet it has permeated so much. What would you say to these people?
I would say you're not looking at things as they really are. Yeah, I mean, it's one thing to have an opinion on paper as far as, and I think really that's, to some degree, that's really what's happening here, is you have a fair amount of people, you know, having this opinion without actually experiencing a whole lot of life, too.
Hmm.
What I find very interesting is that the people who often have some real honest-to-goodness experience in life as far as how things work tend to be less pie-in-the-sky-ish as far as how they think the world operates and what is ideal.
Well, I also think that there is a lack of understanding that there are some moral principles that are absolute.
Yes, there is definitely this idea that people can be whatever they want to be, that the morals that guide people, that ought to guide people,
that are real,
that there's something very concrete.
Well, I think the error is that everything depends on the situation with every act.
Situational ethics?
So you can justify any particular act as long as the situation allows for it. Now, before very contemporary times, most people understood the rock-solid moral principle of one can never intentionally kill an innocent human being. And that means, that doesn't mean sometimes, it means never.
Yeah, I would say too.
That was a moral.
I would say I would largely agree with you on that. I mean, if one looks at each spot in history, you're going to find, people that think differently than the norm.
Yeah.
But as far as what is considered morally right,
sure,
I would say I would agree with you.
I mean, obviously there was always murder.
Yes,
from Cain killing Abel all the way up till today.
Yes,
that's not what we're talking about, though. We're talking about people who understand what murder is. Today they don't. Today we kill innocent human beings all the time, as long as they're hidden in the womb, or now that they have little hope and that they're suffering at the end of life. So no longer is that moral absolute understood to be morally absolute.
Well, there's a certain creep that's been happening over the decades.
Mm.
So this murder in the womb, right, which I think is right to call it that, has its roots in a contraceptive mentality, which is far more hidden.
Right.
Right. This idea that we in the royal we sense can have sex without consequences.
It really began the
pleasure
whole...
Pleasure without unity.
It really began the whole mentality that we are the arbitrators of human life.
Yeah.
Contraception and the invention of the pill really began that mentality permeating the masses, you could say.
Well, I think it had been existing long before that, but that's certainly a watershed moment. It enabled a population to lie to themselves and say, here's a foolproof way where we can just go about willy-nilly and have an exciting time, just like we're going to the park and playing Frisbee. Only.
Sure. And, of course, the contraceptive mentality gave birth, no pun intended, to the abortion culture because little tiny human beings became quote-unquote mistakes.
Sure.
Because they
That's actually part and parcel of Planned Parenthood's strategy in placing their clinics. For example, they'll place them over in near colleges, and what do? They give out free contraceptives. Ones what they know will eventually fail to one degree or
another.
Well,
not only that, it'll encourage them more to have sex outside of marriage, irresponsible sex.
Exactly.
And, of course, that they'll get pregnant, and then
they know people forget to pop a pill here or there.
And then, of course, Planned Parenthood makes a lot of money on killing little preborn children.
That's it. Over 50% of the revenue is from abortion.
So we created this abortion culture beginning in the 1970s, and then, of course, that kind of mentality is going to continue to creep up in our consciousness as a culture to the end of life, where people are, it's different, of course, people are suffering very often, and they have little hope or they have a fatal disease. So I think the biggest reason why people are for euthanasia or are having the option for it in physician-assisted suicide is because they fear suffering. They don't want to suffer. And of course, on the one hand, you can empathize with that. Nobody likes suffering. Suffering hurts.
Yes, it does.
And if there is palliative care, but if it doesn't take care of all of it, then there's still going to be some pain and suffering. Isn't this reason enough? I will play the devil's advocate with you. Isn't this reason enough to say, okay, There should be an out for this, and that out is euthanasia.
Well, that's what some people would say. I think they're clearly wrong in that respect.
Tell us why.
Well, on the point of suffering, all right?
Yeah.
So suffering, we would say, is an evil. It's a physical, mental evil, depending upon the variety that someone has.
Physical evil. Yeah, it hurts. It's pain.
It's pain. And what good does it do?
Okay.
Well, one is on a natural level, we can say it helps build character in a human, right? Fortitude. This virtue that we can persevere through. But I think even more fundamental than that, on a much, much deeper level, is the fact that, and this answer, of course, we get from religion, is that suffering has real, real eternal value, not just for us and our souls, but for others as well, too.
So it's very important for a person to have that opportunity to atone for their sins.
Yes.
Because that could actually be the difference between heaven and hell for all eternity for this person.
Absolutely. And it's not to say that people are willingly taking on suffering. It just happens in life. But then to take that and say, yes, I want that to have value. I enter into that. There's this passage from Paul in Scripture where he talks about, I make up in my own sufferings what is lacking in the sufferings of Christ. So if Jesus is God, right, whatever he did is perfect. And people say, well, isn't that enough? Well, the answer is actually, no, it is not. Because we're not robots. We're created with free will in order to choose whether or not we have a responsibility with that to love, right? And so we basically have to respond. So if God gives a gift to us, we have to in turn have to accept that and then enter into that dance, that union.
So this notion of penance, and of course this is the Lenten season for Catholic Christians, the notion of penance is the notion that we have done wrong. We have sinned. We have done injustices. And in order for us to purge ourselves of that, to become, to purify ourselves of those sins, suffering is a good way, of course, taking on suffering with a good attitude is a good way to purify oneself.
Yes, indeed.
And of course, to humble oneself, to get right with God. And what could be more important than doing this at the end of one's life? If you short-circuit that process with euthanasia, a person would never have that opportunity, and they may very well need it. And again, it could be the difference between their, you know, what happens in their eternal destiny between heaven and hell.
Oh, absolutely! It's like an athlete, right? And they're training for a race, but instead of actually going through the training, they say, well, you know, why do I need all the suffering that goes with running, jumping, lifting weights, whatever it is you need to do to train for your event?
One more thing I want to say about this, and that is a lot of people say that euthanasia or physician-assisted suicide, the person is no longer suffering. Now, I want you to think about that statement for a second. The person is no longer suffering. And usually...
How do they know?
Exactly. There's two things to say about that. Number one, how do you know? Because if you come from a Christian perspective, euthanasia is a violation of the fifth commandment, you shall not murder, and hence they could be suffering a lot more if they ask for euthanasia because you have violated God's commandment before you died.
Well, and our beings aren't just physical, they're spiritual too.
Right.
Spirit has no matter, so when our physical body dies, what happens to the spirit?
Exactly. Now, to a materialist who doesn't believe that, when they say the person is no longer suffering, now that is nonsensical too, because in order for a person not to be suffering anymore, you have to have a person who is no longer suffering. But to the materialist, death means an annihilation. So you don't have a person that is no longer suffering.
That's very unreasonable.
Yes, you're not killing the suffering; you're killing the person. All right. Anyway, those are two perspectives there that both of which. It really makes no sense at all to say euthanasia is good because the person no longer suffers. Both are contradictions. Nonsensical. Well, that music tells us we gotta go. John, thanks for a good conversation.
Yep.
And good to have you here. Thank you all for joining us here in Beneath the Surface. And I hope you able to join us next week again with a different host. Same host. A different guest and a different topic. Have a great week, everyone. You know what's next as well as I do. Cindy's Vinyl Vault with Cindy and Peter. Have a great week.
Looking for a way to build daily prayer discipline? Seen the rise in mindfulness meditation, but not sure if it is possible to meditate in a way that's consistent with your Catholic faith? Just looking for a way to breathe new life into your existing prayer routine? No matter what you're looking for, HOLO is here to help. HOLO is a Catholic prayer and meditation app that helps users deepen their relationship with God through audio-guided contemplative prayer sessions. From meditations on the daily gospel, to the rosary, to daily examines, HOLO has something for everyone. HOLO is the number one Catholic app in the U.S. It is free to download and has permanently free content, but you can also check out all of the premium sessions for 30 days, risk-free, by signing up at www.holo.app/breadbox.